Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In election news today, candidate Gary Johnson had another Aleppo moment. This is MSNBC moderator Chris Matthews interviewing the Libertarian and his running mate on a TV town hall last night.
Who's your favorite foreign leader?
Who's my favorite?
Just name anywhere in the country, any one of the continents, any country. Name one foreign leader that you respect and look up to. Anybody.
Mine was Shimon Peres.
Okay, I'm talking about living. Go ahead. You got to do this anywhere, any continent, Canada, Mexico, Europe over there, Asia, South America, Africa. Name a foreign leader that you respect.
I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment in the former president of Mexico.
But I'm giving you the whole world.
I know.
Anybody in the world you like. Anybody. Pick any leader.
The former president of Mexico.
Which one?
He didn't know which one. Let's talk about this now with one of our favorite political writers, Dave Weigel of The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dave, libertarians are proud of being disengaged from world affairs. So what if Johnson is laser-focused on the USA?
Well, that's not what he intended to do with that question. Since we started talking, really more attention's come to this tweet by Johnson where, given 12 hours to think about his answer, he said, I still can't think of a foreign leader I respect.
Really?
That was his new answer. That's not how he took the question. And having spent some time with Johnson recently, he wanted this forum. He lobbied MSNBC to give him an hour because he'd been cut out of other forums. Two, he's spent a lot of time praising Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico, who should be known for other things, is currently known as a big Donald Trump critic on immigration. So he really just meant to use the moment to praise this guy and completely zoned out on his name. And what worried libertarians, not just the fact he couldn't think of one, you could really throw a rock at Reason Magazine, the Cato Institute, or one of these other libertarian institutions, ask them that question, and with no preparation, they would think of something. They would think of some foreign, if not like a foreign president they admire, a foreign politician who has done good things. There's actually a big effort in libertarian circles, which are all well-funded, to connect people to each other from country to country and what they're doing.
Is it only candidates, though, who have to field live Jeopardy questions if he were actually in office? And he was the governor of New Mexico. Like, is this really that telling about how well someone can govern?
I don't think it's a bad measure at all. As pop quizzes go, I thought asking what Aleppo was a bit strange because often people will consider Syria and they don't think of the particular cities in Syria unless one becomes a gigantic issue that day. The way in the Iraq War, we might have awareness of Mosul or a city that is under siege at a particular moment. That seemed like a little rough. The gold standard for kind of unnecessary roughness is in 2000 when a reporter asked George W. Bush the names of a few specific foreign leaders, the foreign leaders of a few countries, naming the countries first. But a generic question about this, I feel that if you are running for this job, 90% of what you're going to do is related to foreign policy, and if you're totally incurious about it, that is revealing. Is it a disqualifier? Well, maybe not if you don't care about this at all. But it emphasizes that the choice between, in this election, if you're on all state ballots, you will see a former Secretary of State, a businessman who's never been elected to anything, and a governor who doesn't seem very curious about the world.
Well, Johnson says if I could only get up there and be on that debate stage. In fact, have you heard the interview he did, the other interview with MSNBC? I'll play a little of it for you. You have to imagine him suddenly sticking his tongue out at reporter Casey Hunt.
Do you think if you were able to get on the debate stage that you could pull even with Trump and Clinton in these polls?
I do. And it wouldn't have anything to do with my debate performance either. I think I could stand up there for the whole debate and not say anything and emerge as a leader.
I think I could stand up there at the debate and not say anything and emerge as the leader. But we've already decided that Gary Johnson is mockable, so of course he's widely getting mocked for that one too.
Well, I think it's fair. You're talking to somebody who actually voted for him in 2012.
Did you?
I think he got an unfair shake in the 2012 Republican primary. But the odd thing about his debate crusade is that he fell from relevance in the Republican Party because he showed up at one debate, fell below the polling threshold, which was much tighter than the one they used late in this year's primaries. He just didn't perform very well. He just seemed a little bit out of sorts. There's this kind of smear against him that it must be because he's taken edible marijuana, but I know very successful people who smoke marijuana. It doesn't affect them at all.
Name
he
one.
Is just Michael Phelps.
Oh, good, good.
I'm not going to name people I know in their
okay.
private lives.
Okay.
And the President of the United States, et cetera. I don't think anyone accuses the President of the United States or Bill Clinton of being particularly forgetful.
Right.
So it's really just he is a kind of first principles guy who doesn't pay attention to details, and this comes back and bites him in ways, again, I think are pretty fair. He's also just kind of a loose, goofy guy, and I think that's admirable in a lot of ways, especially in terms of what you want from a politician. I think the idea of worshiping a head of government, a head of your state, is a little bit sillier than what Johnson did, which is just trying to stay out of your way, vetoing everything he could, cutting the state's budget. I mean, but the problem with that simplistic approach, as Donald Trump discovers pretty often, is that you have no answers for the hard things.
Talking about the man who has polled at twice the level in Washington State as he has in the country generally, 16% for the Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson here. And we're talking with Dave Weigel from The Washington Post. Johnson has some defenders on Twitter, Dave. One person mm-hmm. writes, to be fair, not a single foreign leader knows who Gary Johnson is either. And even Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, mocked him on Twitter.
She did. She she tweeted a few foreign, I'd say, icons that she respects, none of whom are the leaders of their countries at the moment, which led to mockery for her. But look, it's kind of a silly question, but it's such an open-ended question that it should be revealing about the way you confront the world. If you talk to libertarians who are not running for office, a lot of them would be familiar with the story of Estonia or the new government in Argentina, or just experiments in governments. And anything he said would have been, a decent answer. If he'd mentioned Hernando de Soto, who's not a leader of anything right now, but is a reformer in South America, there's a gigantic world with a lot of policy challenges. And it just seems what Johnson's campaign has been about being the carver, as he says, of a six-lane highway between the parties. That is problematic because if you stand for is an alternative to two unpopular people, you're not explaining yourself very much. And I feel like he's discovering the limitations of that.
Washington Post political writer Dave Weigel. Dave, I enjoy following you and reading you and talking to you. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Gary Johnson just won the Detroit News endorsement, or as he might describe it, the what endorsement? So tweeted Dave Weigel earlier today. And you know we're live tweeting this program at KUOW. I hope you'll join us. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. When you take a taxi in Seattle, your driver is most likely from East Africa. How much do you know about that person's life? Today, we hear about one driver from Ethiopia. He grew up under rough circumstances, but he was able to reshape his destiny. Radioactive Zubeda Ahmed explains his story.
My name is Abdulbasid Hassan. Occupation, I'm a driver.
Hi, good morning, Zubeda.
Good morning, Dad.
That was my dad. My dad's life story is kind of like Cinderella's. How, you may ask? He grew up without a mom, worked for an evil relative, and found his princess in the least expected way. But instead of having a pumpkin carriage, he had a taxi. My dad was born in May of 1966 in a small village in Ethiopia. His mother passed away when he was 7 years old.
I wish he's alive now and just be in my life. I love my mom, and I miss her.
At age 7, he took on the role of his mother.
My brother was 5, my sister was 2 years old, and I took over my mom's spot, and I raised my brother and my sister.
He cooked, cleaned, collected wood for fire, got water from the river, as well as taking care of his 2 siblings, while his dad worked in the farm. How was that at the age of 7? Was it hard for you?
Well, it's not easy, it's not hard, but I have to take it. I have to be in that position.
3 years later, my father's aunt took his little sister from the village so she could raise her. My dad had an unbreakable bond with his sister to the point where he could not concentrate with her gone, so he followed her to reconnect. He wasn't able to see his sister much because his aunt made him work in her restaurant. She's kind of like Cinderella's evil stepmother.
And I work in the restaurant at the daytime, and when I was like 10 or 11, I decided to go to school. I was going to school daytime and working after school and the night in the restaurant. So I was not getting paid.
Imagine going to school from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. and then working from 1 p.m. to 11 p.m. starting from the age of 10 for 8 years. Luckily, he was able to leave the situation.
But I just decided to leave the country in order to find a better life in my future.
So he moved to Somalia at the age of 18 to a city called Hargeisa.
Ended up earning money and I opened my own restaurant.
His business was thriving until
the war came. Civil war broke in Somalia, so everything is upside down, and I ran again from there, end up in Mogadishu.
These noises are recordings of the Battle of Mogadishu.
Oh, that's, I don't know how to tell you, that's the worst life. Many, many times I almost faced the death.
In a few short months, my dad was back at square one. His restaurant got bombed. Despite all this, my father found his princess, my mom. This song is by an artist both my parents enjoyed during that time period when they met. My mom left Ethiopia a few years after my father, with the same hopes of finding a better life. She walked from Ethiopia to Somalia with a group of friends and arrived during the civil war.
We both refugee. I was before her in Somalia. She came during civil war. We met one another. And after that, we come to Barbara, from Barbara to Mogadishu. After that, we got married.
Both of my parents came together to America in May of 1990. Though they both arrived to a safe new home, the change was not easy.
That was big, big change. We are lucky to live Somalia and recently in the United States. We got a chance to live here, to come here. And this is a big change. Everything is new. It's like a happy time and sometimes a hard time.
Now he has grown his own village. I'm number 4 of 7 children.
Hey girl, hey.
For him, life would be totally different if it wasn't for the migration to the US.
But if I live in Ethiopia, there is no opportunity. Maybe farm, maybe just work in day laborers.
Today, my dad's a taxi driver. He doesn't like it, but it pays the bills. My father went to community college. However, his biggest dream is for his children to receive the higher education that he never fully got to pursue.
My big dream is my kid to pass me. My dream is my kid to be highly educated, live better life, be good citizen, not to forget where they come from.
I recently graduated from both high school and community college. I am 17 years old, and I will be entering my junior year in college at the University of Washington, Seattle. I wrote a thank you letter to my dad and recorded his reaction. Here it is.
Dear Dad.
Dear Zubeda.
I want to say thank you for all that you have been through and sacrificed in order to get a better life. I won't forget your resilience to keep on pushing. Hopefully, I'll make you proud.
You make me proud every day. Thank you.
I love you, Dad.
I love you back, Big Z.
Okay, Big Z. Have a great day. Do the right thing, okay?
Okay, bye.
For Radioactive, this is Zubeda Ahmed.
Big Z Zubeda Ahmed started classes at the University of Washington yesterday. Radioactive is KUOW's youth media program. Find us on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. King County is a relatively easy place to be of Asian descent, you might think. There are 300,000 Asian Americans here, and if you're mixed race Asian, well, that's a fast-growing category. It might even be easier. Well, our next guest is here to tell you it's not so simple. Seattle writer Sharon H. Chang has written a book called Raising Mixed Race, Multiracial Asian Children in a Post-Racial World. She says families in this situation have a lot to deal with, and she ought to know.
Well, I have a personal investment, being myself a mixed-race Asian person, partnered with a mixed-race Asian man, and a mixed-race Asian child. So that's where all the questions started. But then as I looked for resources personally to support our family and myself and my partner and our child, I just didn't see much. And after all this time living here as a mixed person, I found that really, really shocking. So I started doing research for me and then also to really improve the canon of literature that already exists on this subject, which is still smaller than I would like to see.
Why was it so hard to find discussion about mixed race Asian families?
I do want to say, going in the gate, it's very important to acknowledge that mixed race people have been with us for a very, very long time, as long as this nation has existed. So that's a really important thing to say. What has changed is recognition of mixed race people. And there was a brief time where the census attempted to categorize mixed slaves, though those slaves did not get to choose themselves what their category was. It was only in 2000, for the very, very first time, that people could self-designate more than one race. And once that happened, the public conversation about this completely shifted, because now we're federally allowed to have that identity. So now the public, the society, feels like they can talk about it. Oh, okay, this is a real thing. Let's see what this means. So up until that point, I think it was like, what are you? You're this and that, half this, half that. I think even the word mixed or multiracial wasn't really even in use until fairly recently, not in a popular way.
So you're kind of nothing because you're not this,
right,
and you're not that.
I remember growing up and always describing myself as I'm half white and I'm half Taiwanese. That was the language I knew to say who I was. And I talk in the book about how damaging I think that is, to think of ourselves in fractions. And
why is that damaging?
It's so divisive, so internally divisive, because kids grow up not thinking of themselves holistically. We always want that kind of holistic well-being, whether it's physical, mental, you know, or all of that together. It's just one of the ways that it fragments our sense of self and our ability to feel empowered and grounded in who we are. So, and I think there's still even problems with the words mixed race and multiracial, which a lot of people will also admit. But at least we've got something that indicates a whole now. So that's why I think we haven't seen a lot. It wasn't something that the dominant narrative was willing to recognize, because it, you know, our government didn't recognize it for so long.
Yeah, about the fractions, actually. I have to admit that my wife is half Chinese, half white, and I'm white, and our kids occasionally will hear, oh, is there a little Asian in there? But not much. They're kind of basically white looking. And I got to say, my family, we talk about skin color and race a little, but we haven't really focused on our kids' identity and talked with them about being multiracial. And your writing opened my eyes about some of the questions that we don't think about and how some parents are in denial.
Yeah, well, a lot of us are in denial. It's not just parents. It's not just some adults over others. I mean, generally speaking, we don't talk about race and racism with our children in this country. It's what we've been taught to do, to sort of keep things in place the way they've always been. And so then you layer onto that, what does mixed race mean? What does multiracial mean? Which is a fairly new conversation, and it gets super complicated and confusing. and I think there's also a piece around mixed race, multiracial being relegated like over there, away from race and racism things. So that's a kind of identity angsty thing that's happening, and here's the real race stuff that's happening over here. And that also makes it very difficult to talk about. So, and, you know, the lack of resources and the lack of support for parents. Well, how do I begin this conversation? What do I say? What book should I read? What picture books can we read together? There's just not much.
Will you tell us more about the challenges that mixed race Asian children tend to face?
Well, it really varies. And I talk a lot about the spectrum of mixed race, because it does rely a lot on, you know, race is a visual marker. So it relies a lot on how you look. So you talked about your children being more white appearing. That is shaping their experience and their treatment by others. Some of the families in my book are Black Asian families, and the children appear Black, and that is shaping their experience. Clearly, they get treated as Black children a lot of times. And we all know, because we see it on the headlines every day, what that means. So it really ranges. I did want to speak to the piece about, you know, quote unquote, quarter Asian or white, light appearing mixed race Asian children, because that's personal for you. I recently went to a high school and was talking to some youth about mixed identity. And we know that mixed race is the fastest growing identifier among youth today. I recently heard 10% of Seattle Public Schools students identify as mixed, which is huge. That's way higher than the national, which is somewhere around 2.9%. So I went into this room. I didn't know these young people's identities, and I sort of went through my spiel and shared some of my research and showed them some fun like BuzzFeed videos. And by the end of class, they were in tears, and it was a lot of the so-called quarter Asian or quarter people of color youth that were in the most pain because they felt pressured to not connect with their grandparents of color. In this environment that we live in, they just felt like they didn't have a choice. So there's some really real stuff that can get very specific for mixed folks in very different ways.
I want to talk a little about the place we live. You did your study, Sharon, in the greater Seattle area. Is there anything particular you found about multiracial Asian people's experience here?
Yes. I mean, the pop out to me right in this moment is in the Northwest, we really have this, what I like to call a pseudo progressive liberal attitude about race and racism, where we feel that we are so progressed. And in some ways, we are very politically progressed, but our racial outcomes are no better than anywhere else in the United States. So in that way, we're very deceived, and it can be almost worse. I wrote a piece for The Globalist that went viral a while back about Seattle needing to shake off its progressive mystique. It becomes a veil, a colorblindness veil that can really prevent us from doing the work we need to do. So that really came up in this book because these families were from this area. They would say things to me like, oh, but it's so much better here. We're in a bubble, so we're safe. Therefore, ... we don't talk about race with our kids. You see where I'm going with that, right? And that's how that particular dynamic is damaging here in the Northwest.
Do you have an example of mind of how a pseudo-progressiveness, a colorblindness, stops us from doing what we need to do?
Yeah, well, like I was saying, this kind of, especially in some of the families in the south end of Seattle, where, you know, we've got that 98118 zip code.
Very diverse.
Very diverse, lots of languages spoken. People in that area would say, well, I don't need to worry about this for my kid because it's so diverse here. They're getting everything they need. I'm not going to talk about race and racism with them. I don't need to worry about it. They're getting their education by their environment. Well, we have a lot of racial segregation in Seattle, and children see all of that when they walk out the door. If you don't talk to them about it, they're not learning. And at least of the 75 children represented in my book, at least 68% had already shown race recognition. That was a conservative estimate, and at least 50% had already experienced racism directly. So that myth about, oh, Seattle's so progressive, we're doing so great here, so I don't need to talk to my kids, ended up becoming a kind of colorblindness where parents couldn't see that their children really needed things from them.
You know, there's an idea that mixed race children, that's our savior, because this is what's going to get us beyond race. This is the generation that has to think less and less about race.
Yeah, that's a myth perpetuated out of the dominant narrative. And I really break that one down in the book. You know, the idea that mixed race is post-race, or the end of racism, it's just ridiculous. The idea that mixed race children, just the mere birth or sheer existence of them would end racism is, you know, it's just strange logic. And then that the burden would be placed on them when they're just children. And what about the rest of us? What is our responsibility for working towards transformative change? All of a sudden, it's just all, let's like unload it on these kids. There's many reasons why that's silly. But we also just can see that that's not true. I mean, as these mixed race identifying populations are more and more willing to call themselves that, we're still seeing tons of racism in the headlines every day. So it has not brought at all a change in or ended racism or a significant huge shift in our racial dynamics here in this country.
And in a generation or two, you don't see us being all mocha, cream, brown, you know, you don't see racism easing in a generation or two because of that?
No, because we need to address the systemic issues in our histories, our unreconciled histories, for that to happen. We don't just have mixed mocha brown babies and then it's all over. We have to dig deep. We have to address these pains that have transferred across generations and generations and address inequities that still exist. And I can't even tell you the number of times I've sat at tables across from people who looked at me and said, well, one day we're all going to be like you and be like Brazil, and it's going to be a moot point. Which, I mean, and this is the perfect example. Brazil is very racist. They have a lot of trouble with racial segregation and very extreme oppression of dark-skinned blacks in Brazil, the last place to abolish slavery. And what happened there was that it just reformed, it reshifted. If we don't address those deep, deep-rooted systemic issues, it just reshapes itself. And so, yeah, we're not calling it maybe white and black and everybody's different shades of brown, but still lighter is better and darker is not as good, right? So that's what we really need to be looking at.
Finally, Sharon, we, of course, people are listening to you now from all over the spectrum of experiences, but is there any one thing you want to tell listeners that they can do starting now to bring a little more awareness?
Can I say they should come to my book talk tonight?
That's one thing. That's good. That's one. Tonight at Seattle Public Library, Central Library,
the nice, beautiful, big one downtown. We're at the ground. We're in the ground level auditorium. Starts at 7 p.m. Doors open 6:30. And there's three mixed identifying folks and one queer Filipina poet who are also coming and joining and doing art. And we're all going to sit and answer questions. So you can come and like talk to mixed identifying people and hear about our lived lives. That's a great thing to do. But I think, you know, one of the early reviewers of my book said it so well. She read my book and she said, what I love about what Sharon said is you've got to do you first. So the very first thing I always tell folks to do is turn the microscope on yourself and start asking yourself really basic questions. Can you define race? Can you define racism? Do you know the history of race, who made it up, and how you connect to that today? What's your racial identity and how do you feel about that? That was one of the things in the book when I asked, for example, white parents how they felt about being white. Most of them denied being white. And it showed how much work they still needed to do in acknowledging their location in a racial system, right? So yeah, do you first.
Sharon H. Chang is author of the book Raising Mixed Race, Multiracial Asian Children in a Post-Racial World. I think you can put that in quotes. And you can see Sharon H. Chang tonight at the downtown branch of Seattle Public Library. What about you? What do you think? Do you have any experiences as a mixed race person or as a parent of a mixed race person? Some experience you would like to share? Because we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at record@kuow.org. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. A new show at the Tacoma Art Museum looks at racial identity through the eyes of African-American artists. It's called 30 Americans. It's making its West Coast debut. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman paid a visit.
The Tacoma Art Museum was buzzing with visitors when I got there. Chief curator Rock Hushka pointed out a sculpture by an artist named Leonardo Drew. From across the gallery, it looked like a fuzzy off-white wall, about 8 feet high. But from up close, you see the wall is made of raw cotton.
And by taking these stacks of bricks of raw cotton, Drew asks us to think about the history of cotton in the United States, where the wealth of our country was extracted on the backs of slave labor.
Drew's sculpture is one of more than 40 works in this show, all by African-American artists. Each work reflects on race and racial politics. TAM curator Rock Hushka says artists bring a distinctive voice to the public conversation about the big issues in our country.
They can help us think about and guide us through these really complicated issues about race, about the environment, about politics, and about who we are as Americans, as Northwesterners.
30 Americans is the brainchild of Florida residents Mira and Don Rubel, who own this artwork. The show's toured the country since 2008, but this is the first time it's been west of the Mississippi River. TAM's Rock Hushka's been working for the past 4 years to bring this show to Tacoma. He says it represents the best of contemporary American art.
20 years from now, when somebody writes an art history book about American art, a number of the illustrations in this book will be these exact works.
Rock Hushka's thrilled to have this show in his museum, not only because he thinks it's great art. Hushka says Americans need to talk more openly about race and cultural identity. He hopes the show 30 Americans will help spur those conversations. In Tacoma, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
30 Americans opens at the Tacoma Art Museum this Saturday. You can see photos from the exhibit at our website, kuow.org. Hillary Clinton could be America's first female president. Here in Washington, another historic first is possible this year. Down in Vancouver, there's a candidate for the State House of Representatives named Caitlin Beck. If she wins, she'd be the first openly transgender member of the Washington State Legislature. Caitlin Beck told KUOW's David Hyde there needs to be a trans lawmaker to help make policy, especially when it comes to issues that affect trans people.
If you have a room full of cisgendered people that don't know about the struggles that transgender people are facing, the financial hardships and the financial blockades that they have in order to getting adequate health care, if we don't have that representative trans voice, then we won't have that background and that information that's needed in order to be able to make a decision that would be fair and, you know, ultimately deserving of the trans community.
One of the issues that's been an issue the last year is Washington State now says it's the law that transgender people have the right to use a bathroom or a locker room that matches their gender identity. Conservatives are taking this on. There was an effort in the Senate that failed. There was also a state initiative that failed. What's your message on that issue to voters in Washington State?
I can appreciate that conservatives are wanting to protect women and children, aren't we all? But on the flip side of that, we do have to take into account the damage that that would ultimately do to the transgender community if we are banning transgender people from using the bathroom that their affirmed gender is. I mean, myself, I'm a very feminine person. If I had to use a men's restroom, I would be beaten. I would face physical harm, harassment, probably sexual harassment. And it's an incredibly unsafe situation that we're going to be putting a lot of people in. I mean, it's already an incredibly uncomfortable topic for transgender people as it is. I remember the first time somebody called me ma'am, I was like, I'm going to have to go to the bathroom later. I'm going to have to use the woman's bathroom. And I stood there shaking for about 15 minutes. So there's already so much fear that goes into this that we're now codifying discrimination and harassment. So,
and why do you think that kind of personal experience or stories like that is important for you as somebody who's a candidate this year, as somebody who wants to be a part of the state legislature? Why is it important for lawmakers to have that personal experience be a part of the conversation in 2017 and beyond?
It's a lot like the conversation at the national level. If we don't express ourselves in a way that people understand we're human too, then we're going to have politicians that continue to be out of touch, not understanding of what, you know, the people in their district need. In this case, I have a very strong understanding of the problems that transgender people face across Washington State, across the country, and being able to express that openly and then being able to take that to the legislature where I can, you know, lend that voice for a community that hasn't had that before, it's going to have profound impacts on the future of policy for transgender people.
What would it mean for you? What would it mean for this state if you win this year?
For me, it would be just incredible. I mean, I've always wanted to be able to help people. Politics is the broadest stage that you have to help a lot of people. So at a personal level, I will just be grateful for the opportunity to be able to help people that need it. For the state of Washington, we would be gaining an incredibly passionate person here with a strong voice, strong morals, and the ability to provide that diverse perspective on a lot of issues that we have been lacking.
If you don't win, what do you think it's going to take for somebody else to kind of break that glass ceiling?
I did win 25% in the primary with very little campaign structure, very little social media exposure. I think I had one news story that was about the five Vancouver millennials that were running for office at the time in the primaries. So with no exposure, I was still able to win 25% of the primary. I hadn't even raised a single dollar in my race. That right there is just proof that transgender people, we have work to do to gain representation, but the barriers that we have in areas like Vancouver or Seattle, They're not as big as we'd like to imagine them. Yes, being the first transgender person in the state house is going to be an incredible first for the legislature and for the state, but the ability for a transgender person to get there isn't going to be as big of a problem as we think it will be, especially in areas like Vancouver, Seattle. Now, if this were a transgender person in Eastern Washington, or even just a Democrat in Eastern Washington, I would say you're going to have some trouble, and you're really going to have to market yourself. Unfortunately, it is a lot about looks. The more passable you are, then you are more likely to be taken seriously. I hate to say that that's the case, but it is something that I definitely learned on the campaign trail. Politics is all about theater, and you have to look good in the theater in order for people to buy it.
Democrat Caitlin Beck is running for the State House of Representatives in the Vancouver, Washington area. Her opponent is the incumbent State Representative Sharon Wiley, also a Democrat. If Caitlin Beck were to win, she'd be the first openly trans person in the Washington State Legislature. Beck spoke there with KUOW's David Hyde. KUOW has teamed up with local independent producer Marlo Mack to collaborate on her podcast, How to Be a Girl. That podcast explores the joys and challenges Marlo faces as a single mom raising a transgender daughter. In this excerpt from the podcast, Marlo introduces us to her ex-husband, the father of her daughter.
I'm a single mom.
Hello.
To a beautiful 8-year-old girl.
Hi, Mama.
Can I hug?
I share custody with her dad, my ex-husband.
Remember what you were going to say to your mom?
Did you have a good weekend with your papa?
And we work pretty well together.
Has she had any lunch or anything?
But there's one thing we've never really talked about.
She hasn't had lunch. She had breakfast.
Mm-hmm. Which is the fact that when we split up 4 years ago, we didn't realize we had a daughter.
I'm fine.
You're fine.
We thought we had a son.
Can't remember. She was almost four. She was still three when she told me that she was supposed to be born a girl. Something went wrong in my tummy. You think she was just three?
She was three and a half.
Okay.
Yep. But I had just moved out. I moved out in May, and it was maybe the end of that summer.
Okay,
when
so
she
you
told
have.
Us.
Can you tell me about that time for you? I never have gotten to hear what that was like for you. Do you remember being like, "Oh my God," and or was it like, "Oh yeah, this I thought saw this coming"? Or what?
No, I did not see it coming. And for me, I was in a place of strong resistance to transgender for my kid.
Right.
I was totally fine with it for the rest of the world, but wow, the challenge just seemed too great. And the fear was too big. My initial response was to not fully accept it. And the way that I didn't fully accept it was that our interactions, her and my interactions, were that she would tell me she was a girl. And I would say, well, part of you is also a boy. And my motivation behind that was to not close any doors, not solidify anything.
Right.
I thought, okay, if we leave the door open, then she won't feel pigeonholed like she's made a decision that she can't change her mind about.
Right.
And I want to leave the door open for her to have the easiest life possible. And in my mind, the easiest life possible was to be her biological gender. What I came to realize, and what the gender group helped me with, I think more than anything else, it was really just one fateful meeting that I went to that changed everything for me.
So what happened to that meeting?
It was a fairly crowded meeting. There were maybe 20 people there. And there were a pretty good split of new people like me and old timers who had been in for a year or more.
Right.
At the time, an old timer was, you know, a year.
A year, yeah.
Right. There just weren't very many kids who had been out as trans more than a year.
Not little ones,
no.
Especially. Well, anyone, yeah.
Anyone
right.
Who you would say is a kid.
Yeah.
And so I looked around the room and I looked at the new people in which I was part of, the group, and all the tears and all the fear, all of the just agony that we were swimming in.
Right.
And I looked at the people who had been in for a year and how matter of fact they were about the fact of their being kid being transgender and how totally on board they were with the struggle. The process, the journey. And so I had a real, almost a vision in my head of a spectrum, like an odometer or something. And on one end of the spectrum was fear, on the other end was love. And the new people were in the fear end, and the older people were at the love end. And I knew for a fact that I wanted to be at the love end. And I went straight home and I looked her square in the face. I got down on my knees so that we could be eye to eye. And I said, "You are a girl."
Oh my God, I've never heard this.
And she just looked at me like so much relaxation, like an opening of a flower. And
so from that day on, you switched pronouns and you never looked back with her?
Never looked back. Never once. She just embraced me and I embraced her. And from that time on, we just had so much better time together. And it was a joy.
Is this my little... Mama, I want to perform! You want to perform for us? Shall we get a performance?
I think we're a team act.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Go.
A deer, a female deer.
Right.
A drop of golden sun.
Me.
A name I call myself.
Fa.
A long way to run.
So.
A needle pulling thread.
La.
I know to follow so.
T.
I drink with jam and bread.
And it will bring us back to
The podcast How to Be a Girl is a collaboration between KUOW and independent producer Marlo Mack. You can learn more about the podcast and subscribe to it at our website, KUOW.org. This is The Record. Thanks for tuning in today. In the news, as you probably know, a commuter train crashed into a rail station this morning in Hoboken, killing at least one person, hurting more than 100. Freight engineer William Blaine says there were so many people helping the injured, he focused on getting people out of the damaged station.
Everybody rushed over. I mean, it's just really people, just beautiful people, man, run over to help. So I backed out, and that's when I backed up near a deceased person, right? And it just hurt me. And so I just kind of keep people away from the scene because the roof was kind of like about to fall in more.
We're going to look into what went wrong and how safe trains are and more coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Serial killer Ted Bundy. Sergeant Robert Bales of the Kandahar Massacre, Benjamin Ng of Seattle's Waumee Gambling Club Massacre. All these criminals were defended by the same man, Seattle attorney John Henry Brown. In his new book, The Devil's Defender, Brown writes about his struggles standing up for the worst of the worst, especially Ted Bundy.
One time when he told me that I was his attorney for so long is because we were so much alike. That almost got me to quit the profession, actually.
What did he mean by that? That you're
well,
alike?
He later explained he meant that if he hadn't gone down what he called the dark side, he would have liked to have been a defense lawyer and he, you know, lived the life he thought I was living at the time.
But you struggled with the idea that he meant more, that there was more to it when this man said, "I'm like you."
What bothered me the most was that anybody would think that. That bothered me the most. Then that was that I'll never forget. I recounted in the book that I was staying in a cheap hotel in Tallahassee, Florida, as I recall, and went back and smoked about 5 cigarettes at the same time, and then looked in the cracked mirror and said, "You know, what are you doing here? Why are you representing this person? You know, why are you doing this for a job? Even this is too hard a job. I don't want to do this job." So that dialogue went on for me with 40 years, more or less. So.
Where'd you come down on it? How do you feel about yourself?
I have mixed emotions about it. I mean, I was interviewed once by the New York Times, believe it or not, and they said, "Why do you do what you do?" And I said, and I'm not supposed to swear, but I'll use bleeps. But I said, because it's my bleeping path. And the reporter was very stunned by that. He said, because, you know, TV shows and everything, defense lawyers are all these romantic characters and living this certain lifestyle and everything. And it's not. It's really, I go to law school to tell people not to do this job unless it's their path. So to answer your question, I give some credit to my father, who just passed away last year at 96, that when I started getting well known at doing these things, he was a progressive man. And he said, if we're going to have a free society, somebody has to do your job and has to do your job really well. And then he paused and said, "I'm just sorry it's you." And I think I agree with him more now than I did then, let's put it that way.
Did you empathize with Ted Bundy?
Not in the least.
Because you do write about how you feel connected to everything and everyone.
That's true. Well, and you know, to that extent, I mean, that's a good question, Bill. to the extent that he's a human being and he deserves respect and he deserves an opportunity to tell his story or for somebody to listen to him and try to have empathy for him, yeah, I tried to do all those things. And I think we all should treat each other that way. We'd all be a lot better off if that was the case. But with Ted, it was very difficult. The empathy part from my part was very difficult, particularly when he turned down the plea bargain. Because, you know, Millard Farmer, the famous lawyer who's just one of my heroes, and I worked for days and days to get him a plea bargain. You know, nobody could ever thought you'd get Ted Bundy a plea bargain to save his life. And we did. And then as we're walking into court, there's that famous scene in my book, because it was very dramatic. And Millard, who's real tall and skinny, is in front, and Ted's behind Millard, and then I'm behind Ted, and Ted turns around and says, "I'm not going to do it." At that point, that's when I actually stopped helping him legally.
You seem to care about, obviously, about what you think of yourself, but you seem to care about what we think of you. I mean, you say at one point, is there something wrong with me that somehow makes it possible for me to defend evil?
Right.
You know, I'm not judging whether that's true or whether that makes you a bad person, but you seem to care about whether your motives are good enough.
First of all, I really don't care much about what other people think of me, fortunately, because a lot of people don't like me. I'm a very controversial person. There's a lot of people don't like what I do for a living, don't understand what I do. There are people that think I only take cases for sensational reasons or for my ego or to become more public, and the reality is I don't. Matter of fact, I enjoy my privacy now more than ever. But it kind of comes with the territory. Getting to your real question, I think, is do I question myself, have I questioned myself over a 40-year period about whether my being able to do this kind of work somehow makes me dirty, I guess would be the best word. It's like the analogy I use, you know, looking at the world through a dirty window, you know, just then everything become that way. And I think most defense lawyers wouldn't say that, say I have real questions about this job.
Most public defenders are not so conflicted about it?
I think most defense lawyers I know who are good are probably not as conflicted about it as I am.
What's different about you?
I don't know, probably because I lost the love of my life to a murderer. That's one reason. The other reason is because I think we're all fallen angels in one way or another. I really do.
All of us.
All of us, everybody. And so I'm able to see the good in people easily. And sometimes I do that more than I should, I think. And I was criticized by my father for that also. So I think I'd look for the decent side of people, despite what they've done. I really don't defend the crime. I defend the person. And there really is a big difference. Most of my clients are actually really great people. And I've been making the point in the interviews I've been doing recently is the government's own statistics show that about 5% of the people that are in prison are most likely innocent. Now, that translates to 900 people in Washington State. And I think that's something that people need to hear over and over and over again, particularly with a mass incarceration issue, which is now finally being talked about. Most of my clients are people who you would enjoy having dinner with, really, seriously. But there's certainly a category of people who have done some really horrible things, but they deserve the best defense also.
Well, with the time we have left, let me ask, John Henry Brown, how do you want to be remembered?
I've actually thought about that and said, I'm not sure how much I can control that. I would love my gravestone to say on it, not just another good old boy.
Really? Why that phrase?
Because it's just too much political correctness, good old boyness that's running this country. And if political correctness is an illness, which I think it is, then Seattle's the hospice. Because, you know, political correctness is, we now live in the age of mediocrity. you and people in your profession and on public television and radio are exceptions to that rule, thank God. But, you know, the good old boys have tried to get rid of you many times. And if we don't watch out, they will.
So not just another go-along-to-get-along complacent person, of which there are many in Seattle?
I think so, yeah.
How do we join you in the not just a good old boy club?
Pay attention. You know, I decided last night after watching the latest police shooting, there were two on last night, that next time there's a protest in Seattle, I'm going to be in the front line with my two sons. It's time to take action again, because it's really getting scary out there. Now, I empathize with police officers. I've represented many police officers, and they have the hardest job there probably is. That doesn't mean they can't do it better. And the fact that the disproportionality of minorities incarcerated is something that we just have to pay attention to. I mean, two generations of black men are in prison now that probably could have been treated a lot cheaper and successfully, and then their children would have fathers. So, you know, it's basically just caring and not being politically correct.
John Henry Brown, thanks for this conversation.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
Seattle defense attorney John Henry Brown has represented notorious murderers, criminals, Ted Bundy, Benjamin Ng, Robert Bales. One of his famous clients didn't physically hurt anyone. Colton Harris Moore went on his barefoot bandit crime spree in the San Juan, Skagit County, across the country. Well, thanks in part to his defense attorney, Moore just got out on work release, and he's working at John Henry Brown's law firm. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Will Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson play on Sunday with a sprained knee and ankle? Should he play? Well, today Wilson said he is absolutely ready to go. Is he choosing freely, though, or does the team need him so much he feels he has to play hurt? This was on fans' minds anyway, and then today, Wilson's teammate Richard Sherman puts out a video criticizing the NFL for not really caring about player safety.
Their bottom line business. If you can increase their bottom line, then they'll love you. They'll do everything they can to put you out more, to market you, to make sure the fans buy your jersey, to put your jersey out because it makes them more money. If you're not making them money, then at the end of the day, they're going to find somebody else. We really don't have reason to trust the NFL, and I don't think they mind either way.
There's no sign that Richard Sherman was referring specifically to the Russell Wilson case. However ready Wilson is, he says he's going to start this Sunday when the Seahawks play the New York Jets, and the Seahawks have a bye week, an off week after that. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Pull our podcast down wherever you get your favorite podcast app, iTunes, etc. Thanks for tuning in.